Hello, Roy here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to The Roy Green Show ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Welcome to The Roy Green Show podcast.
Canada has long been a tremendous supporter of the international rules-based order and the processes and structures that have been put in place over the past decades to be able to actually ensure that international law is respected and enforced. And the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, is a key part of that. Canada right now is directly engaged in at least five different cases at the ICJ because we believe in the importance of that as an institution. But our wholehearted support of the IGA and its processes does not mean that we support the premise of the case brought forward by South Africa.
So there's our Prime Minister on the issue of the International Court of Justice, which, of course, just a few days ago delivered its interim report and to the South African charge that Israel is conducting genocide against Palestinians in Gaza and advising Israel not to commit genocide and advising Israel to make sure that its forces, its military, does not commit genocide. The response from the government of Israel to the charge by South Africa is that it is, quote, false and outrageous. And another quote, it constitutes a shameful exploitation of the Genocide Convention that is not only wholly unfounded in fact and law, but morally repugnant. That's one story. And then there's this one, as we found out just earlier in the week. Individuals in the employ of the United Nations agency UNRWA, UNRWA, which supports the relief and human development of Palestinians, they were discovered to have, in fact, had members of that UN organization, 12 of them have had their contracts canceled, to have aided Hamas during the brutal invasion of Israel on October the 7th. Either they provided transportation or they were actively involved in the assaults. Those are the stories that I've heard, certainly. The United States has been very direct on this issue. Canada, not so much, with our foreign affairs minister using the same language we heard in her first statement echoed by Mr. Trudeau some weeks ago. Israel's ambassador to Canada, Ido Moed, has been with us on a number of occasions. This is a particularly eventful week, Mr. Ambassador. Thank you for coming back.
Thank you for having me, Roy.
What is your reaction? What is your government's response to the International Court of Justice interim report in which the UN court instructs Israel to keep from engaging in genocide?
I must share with you, Roy, and with the listeners, that today, as we mark the liberation of Auschwitz, I cannot but think about my father's parents who were murdered in Auschwitz, and for them that liberation came too late. And this is a very important day, not just for us in Israel and for me personally, but for the whole world, to remember that this horrendous crime is the most horrendous crime ever executed against people in this world. And this is when we are talking about, when we are talking about genocide. And it's so symbolic that on the eve of this important day, the International Court of Justice rejects outright the call of South Africa to tie Israel's hand against another group that is trying to conduct genocide against it. They have not hidden this. They've said it, and they'll do it again and again and again. The same South Africa that hosted the leader of a country that was already convicted of genocide is now purportedly accusing Israel of something that has never happened. And this is really a sort of a beside the fact that the court says that it did not make any claim about the merit of this issue. I think it's important to note that the court also called for the immediate release of the hostages, which unfortunately is there is no other side. I'm sure that South Africa will do nothing in that direction, and they are not obliged to comply with such a directive by the court because they are just working for the Hamas on this case. However, it is important to know that Israel was and will continue to be fully committed to upholding international law. And this is what we will continue to do. We published that information in the past. We'll also submit it to the court. And we will continue to do whatever it takes to release the hostages with the 136 that are still held by Hamas and to make sure that Hamas doesn't threaten us anymore in the future.
Ambassador Moed, the Canadian government has reverted to its earlier position with the Foreign Affairs Minister, Melanie Joly, reaffirming the federal government's support for the International Court of Justice, but saying that doesn't mean Canada necessarily supports the premise of the case brought forward by South Africa, accusing Israel of genocide against Palestinians. By extension, I hear the Canadian government saying it doesn't necessarily not support South Africa's charge of Israeli genocide. I see fence straddling by our federal government. Is that how you and your government interpret the latest statement to come from Ottawa?
What we see from Canada is that Canada strongly and unequivocally supports Israel's right to defend itself. I think this is the most important part in the whole ordeal that we are faced with when on 7th of October we were forced to start a war against Hamas. We understand Canada's position. We've also said that it is important to have more clarity because this is a case where it is something that is called for. But we understand, and I must tell you, Roy, we have good cooperation with the Canadian government on all levels, on all issues. And it is extremely important that Canada continues to voice its support for Israel and its support for Israel's right to defend itself against this atrocious genocidal terrorist organization.
You would feel more comfortable, or and let me say it again, you would feel more supported, I would suspect, if we didn't have a government that reverted to previous positions that were not exactly strongly stated.
That is not for me to say. The government is a government, and I think that this government, as with any other in the past, we have maintained the very strong and solid relations which are based on mutual values and the recognition that as liberal democracies, we must do our utmost, not only to improve our people's livelihood, but also to work together to improve as much as we can the world and as at large. And so in this moment, when Canada stands so strongly in support of Israel, we feel that we are in a very, very good place, and it's very, very important for us to have this support because, unfortunately, this war is far from over. We see the threat that is emanating from the north. We see that Hezbollah is continuing to is emboldened and continues to attack Israel, and we know that Iran is behind the scenes, also working through its proxies to broaden the conflict and to involve the Houthis in the south, in Red Sea. And so we have a long way to go here. And so the international community is, and Canada's role also in supporting the effort against the Houthis is extremely important, and we value that very much. This is exactly when we are talking about the international community's cooperation in mitigating this evil that has risen now.
Ambassador Moed, just the essence, please, of what you know and what Israel has found out, and it was your intelligence that discovered this information about these individuals who work for the United Nations agency having participated alongside Hamas, and if they didn't participate alongside, they certainly provided support on October the 7th. Tell us about that, please.
Absolutely. Hamas has been relying on UNRWA for a very long period of time and actually was and is, in our understanding, somehow very much involved in what is going on in UNRWA. So we provided information, just for an example, about UNRWA needing to release some of the teachers. UNRWA runs the schools, many of the schools in the Gaza Strip, and also is responsible for the distribution of aid, and actually has a full mandate over anything that has to do with the UN. We have to remember that UNRWA is the only refugee agency that is set up to assist in one specific case. All other refugees around the world fall under the work of the United Nations Human Relief Organization, UNHCR. And for some very odd reason, there is one specific organization just for the Palestinians. We'll talk about that perhaps in a minute. But they are also holding the monopoly when it comes to distributing aid among the Palestinians. But if you go back to their participation in terrorism, we have provided proof that they've been active in the attack, in the massacre. They have been active in their teach. We know of one specific teacher who held hostages in his home and actually enslaved them, and they made them work and do work chores for the family. We know, and we've shown evidence of them holding weapons and ammunition in their institutions, using facilities of UNRWA to hide and conceal their weapons and their rockets. So there are numerous ways where UNRWA is complicit in the atrocities that took place. But long before that, as I mentioned, UNRWA has become part and parcel of a lot of things that are happening in the Gaza Strip. And I think that also requires very deep investigation.
So member nations of the United Nations must have been aware of what was going on prior to Israel revealing the involvement of UNRWA employees on October the 7th?
It's hard for me to say what other countries were aware of, but it is clear that since the beginning of the operation, the war against Hamas in Gaza, UNRWA did not allow any flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza unless it goes through its institutions. So the UNHCR, the UNDP, all the United Nations agencies that operate independently all around the world are forced to work through this organ, which was actually set up, in our eyes, to perpetuate the refugee issue rather than to support and help the refugees to settle, which is what it's doing around the world. So that's why we see the living conditions of the Palestinians in what is described as refugee camps. They are small houses. It's not a camp. It's actually very small little houses, sheds. With all the international aid that was donated to the Gaza Strip, I'm sure that they could have changed the housing conditions of all the Palestinians there many years ago. There are billions and billions of dollars that flowed into the Gaza Strip, most of it, most probably, underground to create this tunnel network, which is longer than the tube network in London. So we have to ask ourselves, what is exactly the role, and maybe the whole mandate of this organization should be put into question, because does it really help the Palestinians or does it help something else?
Ambassador Moed, let me come back to the International Court of Justice for a moment. Has its interim report caused any concern about material and weapons support for Israel from its allies?
I think that what we are looking at right now is first and foremost our way ahead, our way forward. When we are working to release the hostages and make sure that Hamas doesn't pose a threat to Israelis anymore in the future, this is our main goal. I think that the international community will continue to support that goal, and this is exactly what is happening as we speak. And I don't think that in that sense we can expect any kind of change. But allow me to make just one small remark regarding the information that is coming into the court and through the court to the world. Much of that information is coming from either Hamas-run Ministry Medical Affairs or Health, and the other part comes from the UN, and which UN organ is actually providing that information? That is UNRWA. So we also have to understand that the picture that is being portrayed about the situation in Gaza is completely flawed, and it's very, very difficult to verify. So as was once done with information that came from Hamas-run Ministry of Health about the Al-Hari Hospital, where they spoke about 500 casualties after a bombing in a car park of a hospital, which, of course, was later found completely innocent, completely nonsense. I think the same would apply to much of the data that was provided to the court this time. However, having said that, we are conducting our operation in a way that is in full compliance with international humanitarian law as required in an area of combat, and we will continue to do that. The international community understands that. The call for a ceasefire, of course, was rejected because the court also understands that Israel has a right to defend itself. And so I think that this is our main goal. This is the main purpose. This is the main issue that we need to pursue when we are looking at the situation in Gaza, and when you understand that it also has implications not only there, but on the whole Middle East and perhaps around the world.
We are aware of the court decision. We have discussed it with the Prime Minister, with cabinet colleagues, with senior federal government officials and experts. We respect very much Canada's independent judiciary. However, we do not agree with this decision.
That clip from Chrystia Freeland, the Deputy Prime Minister, Finance Minister. We respect the independence of the court, and I knew it was coming. However, no. The statement is we respect the independence and the freedom of the court. It doesn't get followed with, however, in an immediate federal government reaction to a decision taken by the federal court, and that decision was that the Trudeau government's invoking of the Emergencies Act during the Freedom Convoy activities in Ottawa and elsewhere in Canada was a violation of every Canadian's charter rights, each and every Canadian's charter rights. Joanna Baron is the executive director of the Canadian Constitution Foundation. They filed a court challenge against invoking the Emergencies Act. Joanna, thank you for coming on the program. How are you?
Great to be with you, Roy.
So when you first became aware that the federal government had in fact invoked the Emergencies Act, you're a lawyer, it had been talked about for days, what was your reaction?
My reaction was that it was a massive overreach and it was likely unconstitutional. We had been studying the threshold for the invocation of the act, and we knew that there were very specific legal standards that could not be clearer that hadn't been met, particularly because, maybe we'll get into this, some of the more worrisome aspects of the convoy movement, like, for example, the discovery of a weapons cache at Coutts, the blockade of the Ambassador Bridge, those had both already been resolved under ordinary police powers by the time the act was invoked on February 14, 2022. So we knew that it was suspect. We were agog, though, to hear that it was even worse than what we expected. It wasn't just that the federal government was invoking the Emergencies Act, but they also were bringing in new measures, inventing new criminal laws, such as freezing bank accounts without a warrant. We did not particularly see that coming, but that's why we were the first group a day or so after the invocation of the act to announce a court challenge.
And you can find the Canadian Constitution Foundation at theccf.ca. On your website, and let's talk about this, 10 key passages from the case, which the judge ruled on. And before we do that, Christine Van Gyn, who is your colleague at the Canadian Constitution Foundation, wrote in an op-ed in the National Post that the federal court decision was a, quote, massive repudiation of the Liberal government. And yet we have the Deputy Prime Minister standing up and saying, and I'm paraphrasing here, pretty close, that we respect the independence of the court. However, that troubles me. The however troubles me, Joanna.
Yeah, I think it's Salman Rushdie who said you should ignore everything that somebody says before that. However.
Yeah, so true. Okay, so let's talk about, and you have 10 key passages from the case, and I would like to hear your thoughts and share them with our listeners across the country. And the number one point, and expand on these, please, for us, cabinet was not owed extraordinary deference when interpreting the act. It wasn't up to them.
Yeah, so this was one of the most shocking things at the hearing, which was last April in Ottawa, that government lawyers argued that because cabinet is, as they put it, an apex decision maker, and they were responding to a fast-moving situation, essentially the judge should entirely defer to their judgment. And we agreed that cabinet is owed deference. That's how our judicial system works, that we understand that the executive are tasked with making fast decisions. However, the Emergencies Act also has very clear and very clearly articulated statutory guidelines. So just to say that we're going to give you some deference, we're not going to, you know, we're not going to judge in hindsight 2020. Nevertheless, when cabinet was making the decision to invoke the act, they knew that the Emergencies Act had very specific requirements. And Justice Mosley ended up concluding that they could not reasonably have found that the requirements of the Emergencies Act were met.
And as you began to speak about during the very beginning of our conversation, there was no national emergency within the meaning of the act at the time it was invoked.
Yeah. So on that point, there is the ability when the federal government decides to invoke an emergency to specify, you know, in certain areas of the country. But the government actually found that there was an emergency across the country. And Justice Mosley found that pretty much the situation was limited at this point to Ottawa and the National Capital Region because the Ambassador Bridge had been dealt with, Coutts had been dealt with. There was not a national emergency. And this really matters because the measures that the government took once it had invoked the emergency indeed applied across the country. You could have a police officer stop you from gathering in a peaceful protest in Victoria, BC. You could have your bank account frozen in Prince Edward Island. And this was in relation to a situation that at this point was confined to Ottawa.
Yeah. And the situation in Ottawa, I think, became very evident to many, if not most, Canadians, really was a failure of not proper deployment of police resources. It didn't require the military, or it might have at some point, but it wasn't a proper deployment of police resources, and it certainly was not a national emergency by itself.
Yes. And so there you have a pretty interesting contrast in findings as between Justice Rouleau, who came out with his commission report about a year ago, who ended up finding that on balance, the government could have reasonably concluded a national emergency existed. And Rouleau really leans a lot on this breakdown in policing. And he says, I understand there were other laws available, but because we had this massive breakdown in communication and leadership functionally, the government could have found they needed the act. And Justice Mosley says, no, that's not how that works. You cannot invoke the Emergencies Act as a memorable line just because it's convenient. I think there was a policing witness at the POAC, at the Rouleau Commission, who the way she put it, or he put it, I can't remember, was that the Emergencies Act, quote unquote, greased the wheels. That's not how the Emergencies Act is supposed to work. It's not supposed to grease the wheels and make police more adept at doing their job. It's supposed to be a tool of last resort responding to a situation that cannot be addressed by any other law in Canada.
You know, I was stunned by the fact the Premier of Ontario, Mr. Ford, even following the decision, wasn't an opinion, which Mr. Guibeau liked to suggest the Supreme Court decision concerning the No More Pipelines Act wasn't an opinion. The federal court passed a decision, and yet Mr. Ford stood up and he said he stands shoulder to shoulder with Mr. Trudeau on the invoking of the Emergencies Act. Somebody's not reading laws. Somebody's not paying close attention, Joanna. How can you say that after the court delivers its verdict and its explanation?
Yeah, it's very odd, but I have to say if there's one person who has a whole lot to answer to in this whole situation and who repeatedly refused to show transparency, to appear as a witness at the Public Order Emergency Commission, even though he clearly had relevant information about the different measures that Ontario was taking in response to the situation in Ottawa, because Ottawa, contrary to popular opinion, yes, it's the seat of the federal government, but it is a city in Ontario. So it fell squarely within Mr. Ford's jurisdiction. And I can surmise that he knows that it would be very politically unsavory for him to explain the actions that he took or didn't take. So for me, this is just an act of cowardice to now say that he supports the invocation of the act.
Well, I would like to ask Mr. Ford about this, but he has steadfastly refused to appear on my program since becoming premier, whereas prior to his becoming premier, I could barely keep him off the program. So,
well, politician's going to politician. That's all I can say.
Joanna, of those 10 points, we're never going to get through them at the pace I've been going. So let me just run through the headlines for them. And then if you can put it together for us as a package, that'd be great. So the Emergencies Act is a tool of last resort. Number three. Number four, no threats to the security of Canada within the meaning of the act. Number five. Economic harm is not a part of the threshold to invoke the act. Number six, banning mere attendance at the protests violated freedom of expression. Number seven, the violation of freedom of expression was not a reasonable limit. Number eight, freezing bank accounts violated the right to be free of unreasonable search and seizure. Number nine, the search seizure violation could not be justified under Section 1 of the Charter. And we'll get to number 10 when we wind up the segment. Can you just put all of that together? I apologize for just hitting you with all of that at once.
No. This is what I do. So very quickly, the last resort clause, we spoke about that earlier, just because it's convenient doesn't mean it's lawful. No threats to the security of Canada and the economic harm are actually kind of go hand in hand, because the government had been claiming for threats to the security of Canada that economic disruption amounted to that standard. That is not what the Act says. The Act says that you need a threat of serious violence to persons or property. So just economic inconvenience does not cut it within the meaning of the Emergencies Act. Then there are the measures that were taken subsequent to the invocation. So the things about breaking up protests and freezing bank accounts. And Justice Mosley says, because there are people that just wanted to attend, for example, the convoy protests, although it also applied to protests across the country, just with a placard or a sign and peacefully protest, who are not honking big rigs or blockading entrances to bridges. This was an overreach and it was unconstitutional violation of freedom of expression. It was not minimally impairing, meaning it could have been more tailored. And as for the bank accounts, the government had argued that this didn't even constitute a search. Justice Mosley flat out rejected that. And he said, because of the way that the RCMP was sending information of lists of designated persons, people that were thought to be leaders of the convoy or influencers associated with the convoy, and there was no objective standard. Usually, in order to seize property, like a bank account, you need a warrant, which is signed off on by an independent third party, such as a judge. Here, it was just a bare belief, bare assertion. Justice Mosley says, nope, that is an overreach. It also affected, by the way, people who had nothing to do with this at all. For example, spouses of people who were involved with the convoy who found themselves in a position where they couldn't access joint bank accounts to buy groceries or pay the bills. So thank God we now have a judicial precedent that says that was unacceptable. And I think I've tied that up into a neat package.
You did a great job. Yeah, wonderful. Yeah. So we drifted really from onerous to odious.
Yes.
What do you think is going to happen now with the court cases associated with the Freedom Convoy? What happens now with the criminal charges?
Well, so the criminal charges, for example, the criminal charges brought against Tamara Leach were not brought under the Emergencies Act. So those cases are not affected at all.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, what's very interesting, and we thank you for this, the court made point number 10, the court may not have reached these conclusions without the Canadian Constitution Foundation. Tell us about the role you played.
Yeah, so we appeared as a public interest intervener. We are a legal charity that has specialized expertise in constitutional law and has a mandate of defending fundamental freedoms on behalf of all Canadians. So we were able to bring a broad perspective and, you know, a specialized depth of knowledge in interpreting statutes and, delineating what the requirements of charter rights are. And what Justice Mosley said was there were some private individuals who also challenged the invocation of the act. And he says very clearly that he found their advocacy to not be as helpful. But I just, I really want to tip my hat to Justice Mosley for being incredibly transparent, that at the outset of the hearings, he was leaning towards the government side, but in listening to the facts and evidence and argument and keeping an open mind and being sort of intellectually honest, thanks to the excellent advocacy of the CCF as well as the Civil Liberties Association and our excellent lawyers, he did what a judge was is supposed to do, which is take an impartial, intellectually honest view of the law and the facts to come to his conclusion.
Joanna, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Great conversation with you. Joanna Baron is the executive director of the Canadian Constitution Foundation.
You know, I was quite literally sat down in a room in a house, a bedroom with the head of Alpine Canada at that time and my sexual abuser. And they both looked at me and said, you know, Allison, we need to work together on this because if our sponsors find out, we won't have a sport anymore.
Allison Forsyth speaking with us and talking about the fact in the time that she had been sexually assaulted by her national team coach. And she was going to go public, and Alpine Canada met with Allison in her hotel room along with the coach, and they tried to persuade her not to go public because it could hurt Alpine Canada and sponsorship. That was at the time the Hockey Canada issue, and the allegations were out that Team Canada junior players had sexually assaulted a woman after a tournament. That's all we knew. And you remember all of the issues that started to swirl around Hockey Canada, which ended up with the entire board leaving and the place being restructured. So this week, the Globe and Mail reported five members of Team Canada's junior team in 2018 are facing sexual assault charges, and they've been ordered by the London, Ontario Police Service to turn themselves in. So the question is, well, one of the questions I have is, how will the London Police Service investigation have taken place? Will the fact that none of the players ordered to turn themselves in refused to do so, all of them refused to do so voluntarily earlier, I wonder whether that's going to be viewed negatively. Hank Hedzinga is the former commander of the Toronto Police Service Homicide Squad, an AM640 Toronto crime specialist, our Chorus radio station in Toronto where this program airs. Hank, thank you very much for joining us. Good to talk to you.
Hi, Roy. It's great to talk to you as well. Thank you very much for having me on.
Yeah, this case has lingered for years, and there was reportedly an out-of-court settlement between the woman known as EM, who was charging that she was sexually assaulted by multiple players, and Hockey Canada. I mean, that was the out-of-court settlement was between EM and Hockey Canada. Does an out-of-court settlement of a case with criminal implications ever clear such a case from any police investigation?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I believe in this case there was an investigation originally by London Police, and they found the allegations to be unsubstantiated. And then Hockey Canada conducted an investigation and eventually reached that out-of-court settlement between themselves and EM. And that's when there was some public outcry, and London said, okay, we're going to look at this investigation again. So this is a pretty tough position for London Police to be in for the investigators. They essentially have to reinvestigate their own investigation and investigate the Hockey Canada investigation. And they've obviously gotten to the point now where they believe they have reasonable grounds to lay sexual assault charges and have asked these suspects to turn themselves in. So I don't know that I've ever encountered a similar situation. So it's going to be real interesting to see how this plays out in court.
Does it surprise you at all that none of these individuals, and they must have known, They must have known they were being looked at. As you said, London Police Service conducted an investigation. And in 2022, LPS believed they had reasonable grounds to accuse five players of sexually assaulting EM. Does it surprise you that none of them have gone to the police and said, I want to talk to you? Or do you think they may have had legal advice to not do so?
Well, we don't know if they have or not, right?
Well, that's true. But yeah. But if they had, would LPS, London Police Service, now be ordering them to turn themselves in if they'd gone and talked to them already?
Well, any interview conducted with any of these individuals would certainly form part of the investigation. Mm-hmm. And they very well may have been interviewed by London Police. We just don't know that yet. They may have been interviewed by Hockey Canada and Hockey Canada's investigators. There was a law firm involved in the Hockey Canada investigation as well. They may have been interviewed, but it's also well within their rights not to be interviewed. Right. If an allegation like that is made, then they would be classified as suspects and they're protected by law in Canada where they don't have to say anything if they don't want to say anything. So they could choose to do so. We just don't know that yet, whether they have been interviewed.
Hank, how does an investigation such as this one take place? What's the sequence?
Well, this is a tough one. Like I said, it's a matter of reinvestigating what's already been done, reinvestigating the multiple investigations that have already taken place, and then looking for any new evidence, possibly re-interviewing the victim, and trying to really corroborate everything, especially in a sexual assault investigation, that the victim has said. All of the circumstances, all of the details leading up to the sexual assault itself, and everything that happens afterwards as well, including who she has spoken to, what has she said to these people, what has she said to any family or friends in the immediate aftermath of the alleged sexual assault. It's quite labor intensive. You can imagine trying to obtain surveillance video, financial records, trying to place people at different places at different times. No surprise that this has taken close to a year now for London Police to come to this point.
Mm-hmm. We won't know more from London Police until sometime next week. What are you expecting to hear?
I don't expect to hear much more than what the London Police has already said about the investigation. On top of that, perhaps of the accused parties and the charges that have been laid. But other than that, the London Police have to keep things very close to their chests. And they may perhaps appeal for any other victims who may have experienced similar assaults to come forward and really encourage any victims of these types of assaults to come forward and speak to the police.
The continuing story of EM, the woman who has said that she was sexually assaulted by multiple members of the 2018 Team Canada junior team, and how this is developing. Five players have been ordered by the London Police Service to turn themselves in. They'll be facing sexual assault charges. So how might a sexual assault case like this unfold and develop in criminal court? Jake Jessen joins us from Rottenberg Shidlowski Jessen, RSJ Law in Toronto. Mr. Jessen regularly represents clients facing serious sexual allegations. Jake, thank you very much for the time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Yeah, good. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
2018, a long time ago. For many people, yes. Right? Not one player turned himself in to police even once the case generated national interest and police investigation over a year ago. I think that was the second police investigation. Are you surprised, or would players perhaps have hired legal representation who may have advised them not to step forward?
Well, I'm not surprised, first of all, and I'm pretty sure that anybody in that position would have hired a lawyer to advise them on what to do, and it would be an extremely rare situation where anybody would voluntarily go into the police like that. Just on a rumor that they were being investigated. So normally the police don't contact you until they're ready to lay an arrest. This is a bit of an unusual situation, probably because of the public nature of this case, that they've advised these players that they'll need to come back to Canada and surrender themselves. But normally the police only advise you that you're being investigated when they're ready to arrest you. And that's when you find out. But even then, most people do not go in and sort of meet with the police and say, hey, I didn't do it. There's really no evidentiary value to that in making that kind of statement for a lot of complex evidentiary reasons. There's no value to that. It doesn't help that person. There's a time and place to make those kinds of statements. And that's in a courtroom during a trial when a person decides whether they want to testify or not.
Okay. We've had at least one member of the team say, I wasn't part of it. Say that publicly. What about this case and the way it's twisted and turned and been reported on from so many different compass points? What about this case particularly gets your attention?
Well, first of all, it's the fact that it's such a public case and the way it sort of went about with EM coming first to the police shortly after the incident, going through the regular sort of investigatory process right in the very beginning and waiting quite a while, having the police investigate and then tell her that they're not going to lay charges. And then having to wait a number of years before she came forward and brought a civil suit, which was settled very quickly. Her lawyer has made some statements in the media as to why there was a delay in that respect. Not so unusual in terms of that delay. But having it now come forward again, having the police look again at their investigation a second time and reopening it and now deciding actually there are reasonable grounds to lay charges is quite unusual.
How do you see this going forward now?
I think we're going to find out a little bit on February 5th. It sounds like the London police have probably arranged for them to surrender later on this week and then to make some sort of press conference or statements about that arrest. We'll find out what they are charged with. I expect they'll be charged not just with sexual assault, but a little bit more of an aggravating offense of gang sexual assault, because it sounds like the allegations are that there were five of them in the room at the same time doing this. You might see also charges of forcible confinement. They're all pretty serious allegations. They carry with them some significant penalties and jail time if a person is convicted. I think the public will hear very little about the case right at the outset. The police will want to keep as much of the details of their investigation not hidden, but closed for now, because they don't want to taint the public. This is going to be a public case, probably end up in the hands of a jury. And the more that this information is sort of disseminated, the investigation and the evidence is disseminated, that can actually taint the trial process. So I think they'll want to keep as much details as possible. At the same time, giving some detail, obviously, as to who's been charged, what they've been charged with, so that if there's anybody else, any other victims or complainants, that they can consider whether they want to come forward as well.
Jake, we often hear about sexual assault cases in the courtroom being particularly rough on the alleged victim. And I've talked to victims of sexual assault who've said to me, if I knew what was going to happen to me in that courtroom, I never would have come forward. Does this case have the potential to become particularly rough on EM?
Well, I think it goes without saying that, first of all, every criminal case is tough on the individuals testifying or involved in the case. These are not enjoyable activities to be part of. And you know, everybody finds it difficult. And especially in these kinds of cases, where the reason why they're mostly difficult and why they're said to be some of the most difficult types of cases to address is because there's usually it's a matter of credibility and what we call in our business, he said, she said kind of situations, where there's usually a lack of forensic evidence. And there's also issues of intoxication, as we see in this case. It just makes the whole experience a little bit more difficult to determine what actually happened. And that's why tough questions need to be asked of all witnesses, not just the complainant, but if the accused individuals, you know, decide that they would like to testify too, tough questions will be asked of them as well. And it is a difficult process for everyone. I expect, you know, the complainant, she has legal counsel. That's a good thing. That's always advisable. It certainly makes the process smoother, better for everyone when everybody has a lawyer, allows them to be informed. And I expect that she will make use of that, that will assist her. But I don't doubt that it will be difficult for her. It sounds like she didn't want this process to be sort of publicly played out, at least some of the statements that have been made on her behalf in the media. Unfortunately, you know, due to the nature of who we're dealing with, I think that's not going to be the case.
I've never asked a criminal lawyer this question, and I should have. How do you structure a case when you're defending someone? If you're a client, if you're defending someone like EM, what's the first thing you do? How do you structure a case?
Well, I think the first steps is, well, you know, with any type of case, whether it's sex assault or not, but you're looking at the evidence first. So what is the actual evidence? Are there forensics to corroborate the allegations? You know, for example, this happened in a hotel. Are there surveillance videos from the hotel that demonstrate, for example, EM walking in with the first accused person? Was she able to walk on her own volition? She's claimed that she was intoxicated. Is that apparent in the videos? Things like that. And you're looking at also her statement and her allegations of what she remembers happening, who was involved. And then there's really a question as to, you know, your client's version of events. Were they there? Were they not there? Did it happen? Did it not happen? And if there was some sexual activity, was it consensual? And what were the indications that the other person was consenting to that sexual activity? So it's a real tough, complex analysis of not just the evidence that's been presented by the police, but also looking at your client's version, understanding and recollection of what happened and what they were thinking,
okay,
and addressing whether or not there's a defense.
Travis Kelce, I think we can safely say, is her boyfriend, superstar Taylor Swift's boyfriend, because he shows up at all the Kansas City Chiefs games. If you saw her in Buffalo last Sunday in the suite, that was a rockin' place with Travis's brother, who's the center for the Philadelphia Eagles, jumping out of the suite into the crowd shirtless. He'd had a few pops, I guess. So I got to thinking, will Taylor Swift be at the Super Bowl? Because a little light went on in the back of my head that said maybe she'd perform there. I know they have the whole thing planned, but it wouldn't be impossible to have that happen. So I thought, well, why don't you take a look and see where the Eras Tour is going to be, Taylor Swift's Eras Tour is going to be, on February the 11th, on Super Bowl Day. Well, there's nothing planned. There's nothing on the schedule, which made it interesting to me. But then I saw that on the 10th of February, the day before the Super Bowl, the Eras Tour stops in Tokyo, which isn't exactly around the corner from Las Vegas. So I did a little bit of research, and I found that Super Bowl LVIII, will they stop with the Roman numerals, please? I think that's 58, is quite a long flight from Tokyo. Although, you know, she's not going to be flying commercial. She has her own jet. So, okay, I do a little investigating, and I see that the flight from – are you still with me or are you tired? The flight from Tokyo – stay with me. The flight from Tokyo to Las Vegas for the Super Bowl, if she leaves right after the concert in Tokyo, jumps into the private jet and starts heading for Vegas, it's only 11 hours and 30 minutes in the air. That's a long time. Okay, stay with me. So she goes to the Super Bowl to support her boyfriend, Travis Kelce, in the private jet. But the Eras Tour has to continue. When does it continue? She's got a couple of days. It's 16th of February in Melbourne. So how long does it take to fly from Las Vegas to Melbourne? I'm glad you asked. It's 16 hours and 48 minutes. So I'm going, all right, so 16 hours and 48 minutes, 26, 27 hours. That's almost 28 hours in the air in a very short period of time, because she can't just fly to Melbourne the day of the concert. She's got to get there sooner for sound checks and rehearsals, right? So my question is, what the hell do you do for love? And if those two are in love, we're going to know for sure if Taylor, all the rumors, you can forget about the rumors, we'll know. If Taylor Swift shows up at the Super Bowl, that's if the Chiefs win tomorrow. If the Chiefs, that's what we're doing it today. If the Chiefs lose tomorrow, it won't matter. But if they win and they're in the Super Bowl and Taylor Swift is at the Super Bowl, you know it's real love. Let's see what my good friend Eric Alper, that ericalper.com, has to say. Eric, 16 times Juno Award winner and nominated 6 times as Publicist of the Year during Canadian Music Week. If anybody knows entertainers and the entertainment world, it's Eric Alper. Am I out of my mind, Eric?
No, but you're forgetting one thing, though.
Of course.
You're forgetting the ability for Taylor Swift to fool everybody in Tokyo and use holograms. No, I'm only kidding. No, this is
AI.
This is not even a blip in the minute-by-minute details of somebody's life when you are Dave Grohl from the Foo Fighters or Taylor Swift or Coldplay. These are just things that you mark down and you have enough money to make it happen. Without question, she is going to be there at the Super Bowl. She's definitely not going to perform. She would never, ever be second to Usher in anything, especially on a world stage. But she will absolutely be there, and I wouldn't be surprised maybe if Travis decides to get down on his knee. And that's the only.
Oh, that's a good angle. I like that.
That'd be amazing, right? Then they can both go to Disney World and be done with it.
Hey, listen, but she has to be in Tokyo in person. She has to be there in person, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But Dave Grohl from the Foo Fighters, like, just, you know, I know that we can get off of Taylor for a second. Dave Grohl went from Australia, did a show, went to Los Angeles in order to be back the next day at 8 o'clock in the morning to not miss his daughter's graduation when she was doing public school. So when you're that rich and you can control everything except for the weather, you can control the flights, the hotels, you can have a clear path on the biggest and the most trafficked road and highway. You can do all of that using money. And I don't see this to be a problem whatsoever.
So that tells you how much I have. I get stuck in traffic jams all the time. Now, I remember Phil Collins in the 1980s.
Yeah.
In one of those World Hunger series.
Live Aid. Yeah, back in
1985. Live Aid. So he performed in London.
Yep.
Right? And then he flew across the Atlantic. Was that the sequence? And he performed in the United States in the same 24 hours.
Yeah, on a Concorde. He finished his performance at 3 o'clock London time, got on the Concorde, and within a couple of hours was performing almost at the same time in Los Angeles. In Philadelphia, which... that helped with the time zones too. So yeah, I mean, you've got the ability to do something like this. It's fun being a rock star when you can do this. You know, there's a lot of events where, you know, the minute that a band like U2 or artists like Justin Bieber, Shawn Mendes, Taylor Swift, the minute that they finish their last song, they don't hang around backstage like they used to. They are immediately whisked away underground by limo with a police escort and on the plane within 45 minutes.
I got to tell you, my friend and I saw Bruce Springsteen in New York, Springsteen on Broadway. And, you know, where he tells his life story and he sings, and it was a great performance. When he came out, the crowd had gone outside to see him leave. He stopped the limo and he got up on the floor of the limo, leaning on the roof, and he was talking to the people there for about half an hour.
Yeah.
It was really cool to see him do that.
Where else is he going to go? He can be home in 20 minutes.
He could be home in no time.
You know, Billy Joel did the same thing. I mean, Billy Joel didn't really want to tour that much, and he still lives. He's got a place in New York. He's got a place in New Jersey. And he decided that he was just going to have a residency at Madison Square Garden, and it takes him 30 minutes from door to door to get there. He plays in front of 21,000 people and has been on the first Monday of every month, and has done that by the time that he finishes this residency sometime in the summer, he would have done that 150 times.
Wow.
Playing to 21,000 people once a month. And that's, you know, but that's a new kind of thing that we're being able to do now. Like, you can control airports now. You can do residencies in Las Vegas whenever you want to, or Madison Square Garden. And so it's definitely a different time, for sure.
And, you know, I follow you on X, a.k.a. Twitter, and you have one of the really the best accounts. It's always fun. I check you every day to see what you've been doing. And you actually let me know at that Eric Alper that Billy Joel has some new, we're drifting off course here, but Billy Joel has some new music coming out.
Yeah, he's got a brand new song. That it's his first song in almost 12 years, and he's celebrating it by going out on tour with Stevie Nicks and Sting, and tickets are already, I think, on sale. But he's doing a whole North American tour. Don't Shut Off the Lights.
Oh, I have to see that. I have tickets first.
I mean, this is a guy that said, like, he wasn't inspired whatsoever to write new music.
Yeah.
And he was pretty steadfast about it, because he was like, I don't need to. I still enjoy playing the old songs. I still love going out on the road when I want to and perform. People seem to still want them. So he was kind of doing this greatest hits era stuff before anybody else was, but he just didn't want to record new music. He was like, what am I going to spend a year in the studio for and have 100,000 people listen to it, as opposed to the 4 million albums I still sell in my back catalog?
Hey, what's the Italian restaurant, right? What's the name of that song?
Scenes from an Italian Restaurant.
Yeah, yeah. I heard him say that this was when he was married to Christy Brinkley. He was having dinner at some restaurant in New York City, and he'd written the song except for the opening line. He hadn't come up with lyrics. And the waiter came up and said, bottle of white, a bottle of red, perhaps a bottle of rosé instead. And Billy Joel said, thank you very much. I don't know if the waiter ever got royalties, but he sure deserved them.
No, and that's why you and I are not songwriters, is because the waiter would have said that, and we would have said, oh, that's such a cute rhyme, and then be done with that conversation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hey, Eric, can you stay with us a bit longer?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I want to talk to you about, I want to go back to Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce and ask you, how you would handle this. First of all, do you think she'll do it? Do you think she will fly from Tokyo? You already said she'll be at the Super Bowl. So yes, your answer is yes.
100%. It's not even in my question that she went.
So they're deeply in love, right? That's your take?
He needs to marry her. Yeah. This is the only way out for him, is marriage.
Why do you say that?
Because if they break up, you can better believe that he needs to retire, because he is going to be harassed every minute of every day of his life by Taylor Swift fans. And for fans that are like, is Taylor Swift not good enough for you? I think that it's heading in that direction for sure.
Oh, yeah. Forget about the Football Hall of Fame, even though he should be a first ballot inductee. Okay, Mr. Alper, you're the publicist. They have just come to you, Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce, and they've said, we're just listening to you talking to Roy Green. Not likely, but. And we're getting married in 6 months, and we want you to handle all the publicity for us over the next 6 months. First of all, how much do you charge them? Secondly, what do you do?
I charge them $1.3 million a month, because that is going to be probably taken up 24/7. But basically, the biggest thing that I think people have to realize is that, yes, there, since the beginning of Hollywood, there has always been fake relationships and fake marriages for PR strategies. It happened in the 40s and 50s with Hollywood stars. It happened in order to cover up gay and lesbian affairs that were going on in the music industry when it was still taboo and in some cases illegal to be in same-sex marriages or relationships. And so the basic reality is that if they came to me and said, we want to get married on September the 1st, 2024, my advice would be to go get married privately and secretly sometime in July. And so that if anything happens, if there are 5,000 fans outside of the public venue that you have announced in September, then you know for sure that it won't get ruined because you've already been married. In fact, Taylor Swift has already said that when they actually stepped out for the first time as a couple, they were already dating for weeks and weeks beforehand privately, because she said that she just wouldn't be that stupid in order to have the paparazzi ruin their first couple of dates. So she's pretty crafty, and she's got a really smart team around her. So it would basically be, you know, understand what the perception of your relationship is going to be, meaning that the fans are going to acknowledge your relationship as a Hollywood one and as a fairy tale one. So they're always going to relate what's going on in their lives to, you know, to kind of compare it and go, well, if this is love, then maybe I should be deserving better and so forth. But I think basically, though, there's no question in my mind that they're going to get married in a private ceremony before we even realize it. And then have a party later on and invite whoever you want.
So it's a done deal.
I think it's a done deal. I don't believe that this relationship, I mean, it is so classic Success America. You know, the one of the world's most wealthiest entertainers in history marries a star football player who is well on their way to winning a second Super Bowl. It's an all-American story. The cheerleader marries the
quarterback,
tight end.
Well, the tight end in this case, yeah.
But yeah, it's a perfect story that fits neatly into the narrative of that Taylor Swift can do no wrong, and if she ever did wrong, it's erased and scrubbed from social media so nobody realizes it.
So on the 10th of February, when she's playing in Tokyo, this is again assuming the Chiefs are going to win tomorrow. If they lose, it won't matter because she can – she won't be in that much of a rush. But it'll just be him going to the next concert in Melbourne. But if the Chiefs are in the Super Bowl, it's a foregone conclusion that Taylor Swift on the 10th of February – will be boarding a helicopter seconds after her concert ends, be flying to, I think it's Narita Airport in Tokyo, and off to Las Vegas, 11 hours and 30 minutes on the private jet, having a good sleep, and then seeing her fiancé. Should we break it here? Are you breaking news?
Yeah, her fiancé win his second.
What a story, Eric.
If this comes true and we are right, we need to just play this forever. And if we're wrong, then we delete it from the internet.
Yeah, if we're wrong, it'll never be spoken of again.
Just forgotten about. Yeah, we're right. Yeah,
forgotten about what?
Man, are we geniuses.
Forgotten about what? Have you ever been wrong on anything?
Oh, all the time.
Yeah.
My whole day is trying to figure out what is going to go wrong to make it right so that it doesn't kill anybody or their careers. Oh, there's hundreds of songs that I thought were easily number one hits and stalled at number 47 because of one reason or another. Yeah. Think about how many things have to go right in order to have a box office success. All those names at the end of the credits in a movie, any one of those people could have messed up the entire film. And a worldwide company in every major country has to be on target.
Eric, Billy Joel's pushing you off stage.
Yeah, yeah.
Got to go. Thank you, my friend. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Roy. We'll talk soon.
Yeah, you bet.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you want to hear more, subscribe to The Roy Green Show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorites. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review and tell a friend. I'm Roy Green. Have a great weekend.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.